and leave a message for us with news to share on the show or an audio message for your loved ones inside.
You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
CKUT Radio.
Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
Welcome to Legalese, a broadcast about law cast broadly. Bienvenue à Legalese, une émission consacrée aux droits qui vise à rendre le jargon plus accessible tout en évaluant de manière critique ses institutions. I'm Camilla, your host for this month's edition of Legalese. Today we're discussing the government's response to the pandemic and how their strategy has failed to protect the most vulnerable members of our society. First, you'll hear from Jessica Quijano, and then we catch up with a few of our McGill law peers. Jessica Quijano is, among many things, an activist and street outreach worker for Montreal's Native Women's Shelter. She's also a frequent spokesperson for the Defund the Police Coalition of Montreal. For full transparency, we want to acknowledge that Radlaw McGill, which produces Legalese, is a member of the Coalition to Defund the Montreal Police. We actually had a chance to interview Jessica last summer in the midst of the global outcry against police violence on Black and Indigenous people. We catch up with Jessica today to revisit the coalition's demands and talk about the impact that the government's pandemic response has had on Montreal's marginalized populations, like those in our community who are suffering from homelessness. In particular, Jessica highlights the collateral harms that result when police are centered in the public health crisis response. And she also discusses what should be done instead. This is Legalese's Brett speaking with Jessica.
I was just going to start by asking you to talk a bit about the Defund Coalition and its goals.
Okay. So the coalition, Defund the Police, we have several demands. I don't know if you've seen them. They're to reinvest in communities, to decolonize, decriminalize and disarm. So when we talk about disarming all police, we're talking about decriminalizing sex works and drugs and the bylaws that target people in poverty, like loitering or drinking in public, and really decolonize, look at Indigenous models of restorative justice and, that already exist throughout the country. So it's within an abolitionist framework, but we were asking for the City of Montreal to cut the budget 50% from the $665 million budget. So we wanted, instead of for reinvesting, we want it to be reinvested in housing. We also want to get police out of schools, invest in education, support, especially we want to uplift Black and Indigenous voices and support more areas in Montreal that are dealing with poverty. The coalition to defund the police is getting to the root causes of a lot of issues, society's issues, and just approaching people with care instead of criminalizing them. And in the work that I do, I often intervene in mental health, in addiction, homelessness. And so it's kind of that we're already doing this kind of work. We just want to support community organizations so that they can, more effectively serve the communities.
Right. Makes good sense. So this is a pandemic somewhat focused episode, but we reached out to you because, throughout the pandemic, we've seen the Quebec provincial government treat the health crisis as a sort of public security issue, and making heavy use of the police to enforce restrictions that were enacted in the name of health.
Right.
So, you know, as a member of the Defund the Police Coalition, what are your thoughts on that approach?
Well, I mean, it's not an approach that works. And we know, like, during the AIDS pandemic, criminalization doesn't work. So actually giving tickets or, like, they have been doing, like, for example, ticketing the homeless, it doesn't actually make people to, for example, follow the guidelines, the pandemic guidelines and so forth. Also, it's really targets a lot of people who are in poverty, especially the homeless population, where they're already targets by police, and it just gives them one more reason to target them. And we saw, like, tragically with Rafael Nada Andre, of the consequences of that, when you input the, how the curfew was enforced and a lot of homeless people were didn't have access to night shelters, like drop-in spaces. As well, there's been a huge drop in people using supervised injection sites, which is really worrisome. So that means people are using alone. So we know there's going to be an increase in overdoses. So it has a really detrimental effect where it really is a life and death situation by putting more police, by putting stricter measures. When what should be really be done is focusing on giving people health days. In manufacturing, there's a lot of COVID outbreak. Giving people housing, giving them people detox and resources. That's really what will help people to be comfortable and be able to follow the measures, not by criminalizing them and ticketing them.
Right, and you brought up the the death and then the subsequent sort of injunction that suspended the application of the curfew for the city's residents suffering from homelessness. But I'm just curious, how has that shaken out to your knowledge, like, on the ground? Are police respecting that, or you find homeless residents are still being sort of harassed or ticketed? Or
I mean, the homeless office is always harassed by police, and even when they had, like, we had like exceptions for, let's say, people with to go to, say, consumption sites under the curfew, you could have a letter because it's a medical issue. But many of the people that I work with are like, I'm not going to go on alone and walk around the streets during curfew when there's no one around and the police are going to stop me, answer a letter, and they can ticket me on something else. And also, it kind of shows that I have drugs on me. So, police can find any way to intervene with someone who's homeless. So definitely they've increased police presence, and there's, like, less watching out for each other because there's less people around. So it's definitely not safe.
Right.
It's not safe for people on the street. It's actually a lot less safer.
The pandemic, you mean, is, and the context of this increased police presence
yeah.
has made it less safe for...
Yeah, and also people have a harder time making money. A lot of people on the street, they work during the night. They panhandle. They might be in the sex trade. They might sell drugs. This is all done during the nighttime. So you've got rid of a whole economy. And we're seeing that's when we see when people are really in situations of poverty, that's when we can see violence increase.
Right.
So it would be also to provide adequate, like, social assistance. CERB was an indication of what you really need minimally to live. Like, but people on social assistance get like $700 a month.
Right.
So it's kind of this idea where, and they weren't eligible for CERB. So it's about strengthening those social safety nets so that people aren't struggling and they don't necessarily have to go out on the street and maybe do something, do their hustle to just eat and just, like, live, or maybe, and having an addiction issue is a health issue. It's not like you can just stop from one day to the next without adequate support. And, like, right now there's no detoxes available. The wait lists are really long because they're at half capacity. So it's just, I think people think that if we remove police, we would see, like, increases people in crime. But when we talk about defunding, it's about replacing it with adequate support. And we really wouldn't need any police, because I see a lot of what police do. And oftentimes they're very bored.
Yeah.
So, in my work, they don't really have much to do except maybe target people who are living on the street.
Yeah.
So
So, I mean, I don't know, this is pretty speculative, but what would you say to those who might point to dropping numbers of new COVID cases as evidence that, you know, the approach is working, the curfew and police enforcement are working, and the pros outweigh the cons?
Well, I mean, there has been other restrictions that have been put into place, like for people who aren't being able to go, like, shop. That was one of the things. As well, like, there's been vaccination and so forth. That has probably, but there hasn't been really, and I don't see how, I don't personally see that it's directly related to the curfew. It might have some effect, but overall it has more, there could have been a lot more things done before enforcing curfew. Or if you're going to enforce a curfew, at least make sure that people who do not have a home have somewhere to go and somewhere to isolate. So it had to take a court injunction. So it was already was wrong from the get-go, but the government needed someone to die. Someone had to die because of it for there to take action. So I think that just, you know, I'm not convinced that it's the curfew. And I think it's just by providing more education and support and having increased mental health services. People are also struggling with a lot of mental health issues during the pandemic. So it's more about taking a more holistic approach to this whole pandemic, not just like focusing on the numbers, different ways of how we can decrease it.
Right. Yeah. And it seems, you know, there's a kind of, you know, when we're talking about health and in this context, it's sort of a question of sometimes of whose health is being prioritized as well.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, there were just like the long-term care homes. That was, you know, that's just an example. All the pandemic has highlighted how there's been austerity cuts for the past couple of decades that we have been, you know, denouncing. I mean, I've been to so many protests about cuts in the healthcare, cuts in education, cuts everything, and this is what the impact is. So instead of investing, that's what really defunding is reinvesting in those services. That's what should be done, not in police. So, you know, like we could have like better classrooms, like smaller groups, that the nurses aren't overwhelmed, like so that we don't, so we have more proper response in the healthcare system. Like people are very burnt out. I'm quite worried about the healthcare system. Like it can't keep going much longer. When there's already was a shortage of nurses and teachers and support, it's just at some point, just increasing police isn't really going to be addressing the pandemic.
So you sort of just touched on it, but I'm curious, you know, if that's the wrong approach, you know, I'd be interested to hear more of your thoughts on what sort of concrete measures the government could and should be doing instead of using police to sort of.
It's just would be to give people security, financial security, so that they don't have to maybe put their health and safety at risk of contracting COVID. We had like huge outbreaks in the shelter system. You know, we had said that from the beginning, we're like, we're going to have outbreaks if you have shared spaces. We had asked for housing, hotel rooms early on in the pandemic so we wouldn't have an outbreak. So we had an entire outbreak and that could have been avoided. So it would really be to focus on prevention. And, you know, a lot of times people were seeing a lot of undocumented workers that are going to manufacturing and that are contracting COVID. So it's like we spend an enormous amount of money on police. And it would probably cost like a fraction of the price if we actually provided people with support, and so that instead of policing them.
Right. So I mean, you're kind of already drawing the connection there. But my next question is going to be, you know, so how might defunding the police kind of directly relate to or help us to kind of combat COVID, or you know, just improve public health more generally?
Yeah. Well, it just would be to strengthen the resources. So, like, with the population that I work with, they're always in and out of the healthcare system and the judicial system. So, for the healthcare system, that is a huge weight right now. And so, like, for the example that I gave about the outbreak in the shelters, that could have been completely avoided.
Right.
we're seeing the backlash on the healthcare system, where we had now we're still going through an outbreak within the homeless population. So the healthcare system is taking up that. So it has an impact on everyone. So we also need to remember that police are just reacting to problems. They actually never prevent problems. So defunding the police is really about putting prevention, also just increasing people's quality of life and peace of mind. And then when we talk about, like, you know, a lot of so-called crimes, they really are related mostly to poverty. So it's really important, like, for the drug overdose crisis that we, instead of taking a criminal perspective, which is, you know, arresting people who use drugs or sell drugs, would be more of a human rights and healthcare perspective. So if someone's struggling with an addiction, that we provide them, you know, proper support, detoxes. There's just, like, such a huge shortage of services. And that money could be spent on those services. You know, we actually have the solutions. We could end homelessness in Montreal. I mean, we could end it across the country if we actually put those solutions into place. And so definitely, and the police are just, like, especially when we're talking about the Indigenous community, there's been a huge increase in sexual assaults that I've been seeing in my work. And they're not going to police because they're constantly being targeted and discriminated against on a daily basis. So homeless women don't go to the police when they're a victim of crime. So, yeah.
Right. So I guess, yeah, on in that vein, I mean, talking about reallocation of resources, I want to talk a bit about the different levels of government and their roles in all of this. And, you know, we know that the restrictions on gatherings, on workplaces and the curfew, these were all put in place by provincial government. But if, you know, so if someone's to be blamed, it's, you know, we kind of point the finger there. But also in Montreal, we know that the restrictions are being enforced by the municipal police.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, you know, we might logically, you know, think that the Ville de Montréal, the city, would be able to influence the way that the SPVM carries out their duties, you know, direct perhaps to not harass certain vulnerable populations. Is this something, to your knowledge, that the city could do or has done, or I guess more broadly, what are your thoughts on the city's response?
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting is that the city often seems to show that they don't have a lot of power over the police. So that's really questionable for us as a society. But when we know they do. So like Vancouver, for example, they were able to stop enforcement of people who possess drugs, even though it hasn't been decriminalized. It's a federal issue. There are definitely powers that the city of Montreal could, when they take directives, the police take directives from the city. So they could have done from the get-go, look, we're not going to listen to this directive for the curfew. Do not enforce if it's people who are homeless. Mm-hmm. They could have done that, you know? There's just a lot of lack of political will.
Right.
When you think about it, and, you know, a lot of people, a lot of politicians aren't very brave. They're not very courageous. And they're not really standing up for human rights. And they kind of, this is just a kind of a way of passing the buck. But we see that the governments can act very quickly when they want to and work together when they want to resolve an issue. Like, look how quickly they put together CERB. When they want to put money towards police, the money comes right away. Mm-hmm. So I think it's just like an excuse. If there was actually a political will, you know, if this wasn't, you know, this kind of falls into the legacy of genocide, especially for Indigenous people, because they're the ones mostly affected, at most, missing and murdered. It's often the non-action of government that leads to people dying or of experiencing violence. So it's very intentional in a lot of ways.
On that note, like, of intentionality, you know, we saw how the Plante administration's response, you know, the widespread marches and protests and their own budget survey, in which 60% of respondents supported defunding the SPVM and reallocating funds, they chose to increase the police budget. So, I'm just curious, you know, if you have comments on that move by the city.
Well, yeah, it's just showing that you're just playing politics and you're not really considering the opinion of people, not considering the evidence, not sitting down with community. It's pretty sad. I mean, especially the Project Montreal, they ran on being progressive. And it's actually been a very big disappointment for many of us in community.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing has really changed. And actually, they're quite conservative and are appealing to the upper middle class. Like, it seems like their needs seem to be more important than the needs of people who are really suffering right now. When we talk about bike paths, that gets in. The skating rink at Cabot Square, I don't know if you know about that. They put a skating rink where it's just a huge indigenous homeless population.
Mm-hmm.
They spent $100,000 on a skating rink. We've been trying to get a warming tent, and it took us, the city didn't even pay for that. We had to go to Ganawage pay for it. Some people from the community did. That says a lot. When we're talking about a warming tent that will actually save people's lives, and the city is investing in a skating rink that wants to push gentrification in the neighborhood.
Right.
I think that's just very, very intentional.
Right. I recall, I think the official line was something about an opportunity for the city's homeless and other residents to come together or something along those lines to skate.
It's just so far removed. You think someone who's dealing with homelessness has a pair of skates? it's just really so far from the reality. And I don't believe that was like their intention to put the neighborhood and the homeless population together. It's really a way to displace them.
I have just a couple of final questions. I mean, one would be, what's next on the agenda for the Defund the Police Coalition?
Well, we're definitely going to continue with our popular education. This is definitely going to be an election issue. We're going to be, pushing politicians of what their thoughts are on Defund the Police, what kind of stance they will take on it. And it will be we will be making this into an election issue because it really is a really important human rights issue.
And finally, for those listening who, want to get involved with Defund or support in some way, what can they do?
It would just be to follow us. We have a Facebook page. There's defundspbm.com. There's Instagram. And as well is to write to your local politicians, your city councilor, your MLA. We also just actually, the city of Montreal, the Defund put pressure to put a motion to decriminalize drugs. So that would be to contact your MP. We followed suit and it went through. We followed suit with Vancouver to at least decriminalize the possession of drugs. So it would be as well to contact your MP that you're in favor of this. So the more pressure we put on our local politicians, our message is going to get heard.
Right. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that last motion or what?
Oh, okay. So we did. So one of the councillors, Marvin Rochon, we had met with him. He's an independent councillor. We had talked about the overdose crisis, and Vancouver had just asked the federal government to decriminalize possession. And this has actually been, actually the police actually support this as well. So because the drug laws are a federal issue,
mm-hmm.
Technically it can't be done unless unless the federal government decriminalizes across the country. So this is actually going to putting pressure on the federal government would be to decriminalize simple possession. This should have been done a really long time ago. There's overwhelming evidence that criminalizing people who use drugs in no way is helpful. But we will go further. We're also asking at the Defund to decriminalize all like drugs selling and so forth. So we're really hoping that the federal government will do this because this is just one step closer in ending the overdose crisis that's been hitting us across the country. And in Montreal, we've seen a huge increase in overdoses this past 2 months because of the borders being shut down, the supply is more tainted. Also, people are struggling more confinement. People are using more. So it is really important that people can go seek help and not be afraid of being arrested, if they need help.
Absolutely. Okay, well, thanks so much, Jessica, for taking the time to speak with me, and have a great rest of your day.
You too. Thanks.
And good luck with the push to Defund.
Oh, thanks so much.
Yeah. We'll be following.
Bye.
Bye.
This is Nancy from Not You, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, Quebec.
That was Legalese's Brett talking with Jessica Quijano from the Native Women's Shelter of Montreal. Jessica mentioned the warming tent, which went up in Cabot Square on February 2nd. This tent stands in honor of Rafael Napa Andre's memory. Rafael is the Innu man who needlessly died last month as a result of the curfew, which also applied to homeless shelters. This warming tent is open all night and is a space for the people in the community to come and warm up either for a few hours or overnight. The Native Women's Shelter and Resilience Montreal were behind this initiative, which was funded primarily from businesses and members from Ganawage and other Indigenous communities in Quebec. The outraging circumstances surrounding Raphael André's death fueled public outcry against François Legault's refusal to grant unhoused persons immunity from the curfew. Finally, though, on January 26th, La Clinique Juridique Itinérante was granted the injunction it sought from the Superior Court. The injunction suspended the application of Legault's infamous curfew upon people experiencing homelessness. Judge Chantal Massy, in her reasons, held that la mesure porterait atteinte au droit à la vie, à la liberté et à la sécurité des personnes en situation d'itinérance, et ce, de façon non justifiée, au contraire au principe de justice fondamentale. Noting also that the CAC's assertion that all of those who were houseless could be sheltered was in fact inaccurate, and it lacked understanding of the multiple experiences and constraints within the community. Up next, you will listen to our chat with three fellow classmates, Emily Knox, Laurent Côté de la Grave, and Anna Guinacchiadi. They are all involved with legal clinic work that supports criminalized unhoused folks, namely La Clinique Juridique Itinérante and Resilience Legal Information Clinic. They discuss the criminalization of poverty, the much-needed revitalization of Indigenous laws, and the limits of policing a pandemic, as well as how all of these issues intersect. Here is Legalize's Audrey asking Laurent about their work.
Anna et moi, nous venons de la clinique juridique itinérante, dans laquelle on s'engage depuis l'année 2020. Puis, on peut commencer par les valeurs de la clinique. Donc, c'est vraiment, la clinique aspire à l'égalité devant la loi et à promouvoir l'accès à la justice à travers des services d'assistance juridique. Puis, donc, parmi ces services, on a l'information juridique qui est assez comme élémentaire à toutes les cliniques, mais on offre aussi des accompagnements références et de l'assistance dans la démarche pour se régulariser des dettes judiciaires. On sait que la population des personnes en situation d'itinérance ont beaucoup de dettes judiciaires, justement, qu'on va en parler plus tard, dues à la surjudiciarisation au profilage. Donc, la CJ contribue justement à aider à la réinsertion sociale en s'affranchissant de ces dettes-là ou en les modifiant. Donc, ouais. Voilà.
L'autre aspect de la CJ, donc pendant l'année, les cliniciens vont vraiment travailler dans les refuges avec des usagers spécifiques, puis chaque personne va être assignée à un usager. Donc, si la personne a plusieurs problèmes juridiques, c'est toujours avec la même personne donc, avec laquelle ils vont interagir. Comme ça, ça crée un lien, une familiarité. Mais l'été, la clinique juridique a un peu plus de temps et de ressources. Et donc, il y a des étudiants qui font de la recherche pour eux. Puis, ils ont un projet de recherche en ce moment sur la criminalisation de la pauvreté et la surjudiciarisation des personnes en situation d'itinérance. Parce que, étant donné qu'ils travaillent dans beaucoup, beaucoup de refuges sur l'ensemble de l'île de Montréal, ils ont quand même un bon portrait pour voir quel genre de contravention ces personnes reçoivent. Et on essaie en ce moment de récolter toutes les statistiques puis compiler un grand dossier avec ça pour essayer de voir quel genre de discrimination il peut y avoir. Laurent a travaillé pour eux cet été. Je ne sais pas si tu veux rajouter quelque chose sur ce projet-là, Laurent.
Oui, bien, il y a ce projet de longue haleine sur plusieurs années où on essaie justement de prouver empiriquement une discrimination systémique et à travers une recherche au greffe criminel et au greffe de la Cour municipale, autant à Québec qu'à Montréal. Puis, aussi, peut-être que plus pratico-pratique, on devrait aussi mentionner que une fois par mois, mais là, c'est plus le cas durant la période de COVID, mais tous les bénévoles se déplacent dans leur clinique affiliée. Moi, je suis affiliée avec la clinique, avec le refuge des jeunes de Montréal, près du métro Papineau. Donc, ça, c'est comme ça qu'on rentre en contact avec les usagers. Puis quand on les rencontre et on leur ouvre un dossier, mais après, un des étudiants est comme affilié à ce dossier-là et le suit jusqu'à résolution. Là.
Donc, et même si, l'étudiant termine ses études, il y a d'autres étudiants qui vont pouvoir aller prendre le dossier. Donc, moi, j'ai travaillé sur le dossier d'un usager qui était avec la CGI depuis 4 ou 5 ans, puis qui avait des problèmes qui n'arrêtaient jamais. Donc, il y a eu beaucoup d'usagers différents qui ont pu travailler sur son dossier aussi.
So my name is Emily, and I'm one of the members of Rod Law, and I'm part of the Legal Information Clinic at Resilience Montreal. So when Resilience opened its doors as a day shelter, I think it was the fall of 2019, some of the members of Rod Law reached out to see whether a legal information clinic would be a useful service for the day shelter. And so we launched it, I think about 2 or 3 weeks before lockdown. And so we had to adapt our services really quickly to the pandemic context. But essentially, the services that we provide, we're there on a weekly basis with volunteers from Rad Law, and we're there to just answer, you know, law related questions and provide information or access to resources. And we also offer accompaniment services. So if people have to go to court, for example, to contest a fine. Students can go with them to accompany them in that process to demystify some of the steps, because it can be quite a daunting experience. And then we'll also try and connect them to pro bono lawyers. So there's one pro bono lawyer who we reached out to, especially related to the curfew tickets, who is now taking any tickets related to the curfew or any of the pandemic measures. And he's taking all of those to contest them together. So that's something else we try to do, is just to make connections with lawyers in the community who are willing to lend their time and expertise with some of these issues.
Mais dans le fond, c'est ça. Laurent, Piana, vous mentionnez que vous avez justement un projet de recherche en ce moment sur la criminalisation de la pauvreté. Puis j'avais envie que comme on aborde un peu le concept au travers des expériences à la clinique. Fait que, c'est quoi la criminalisation de la pauvreté? Puis comment ça se manifeste dans vos activités avec vos cliniques respectives?
Eh bien, je trouve que pour comprendre un peu des exemples de la surcriminalisation de la pauvreté ou la surjudicialisation, je trouve que le jugement de la Cour supérieure, justement, pour exempter les personnes en situation d'itinérance du couvre-feu, donne un début, justement, d'explication. Puis, ça m'avait vraiment aidé à comme mettre des idées en ordre. Donc, juste à la base, cette population-là, la majorité ou une grande partie a déjà des problèmes de toxicomanie, ou sont en prise avec des défis de toxicomanie et aussi de santé mentale. Puis, ceci combiné avec la police, où la police doit intervenir. Donc, c'est pour ça qu'ils finissent aussi par être plus judiciarisés.
Pour un peu donner un exemple concret de ce dont parle Laurent, quelqu'un qui vit de l'alcoolisme, par exemple, mais qui a un toit, ne va pas être criminalisé pour sa dépendance, parce que la personne peut aller à la SAQ, consommer tranquillement chez soi, et ce n'est pas illégal. Mais quand une personne en situation d'itinérance boit en public, parce que souvent dans les refuges, on n'a pas le droit de consommer parce qu'on veut aider les gens qui ont des problèmes de dépendance à sortir de leur dépendance, ils vont recevoir des amendes. Et donc, ils sont déjà, de ce point de vue-là, placés à des avantages. Et ensuite, tout le système d'amendes va les amener à avoir, Laurent, on a un peu parlé tantôt, mais des dettes judiciaires parce qu'ils n'ont pas de toit, ils n'ont pas vraiment de revenus non plus souvent, donc ils ne peuvent pas payer l'amende. Donc, on va leur donner un procès. Des fois, s'ils ne sont pas accompagnés, ils ne savent pas qu'ils ont un procès, ils oublient c'est quand la date, ils ne vont pas au procès. Et ensuite, ils vont avoir sur leur dossier un défaut mandat parce qu'ils ne se sont pas présentés. Et ça les criminalise. Et à partir de ce moment-là, c'est dans leur dossier pour toujours. Puis c'est des choses qui vont venir se rajouter, alors qu'à la base, ils ont fait quelque chose que quelqu'un qui a un toit sur sa tête, pour laquelle cette personne n'aurait pas reçu d'amende. Donc, d'emblée, il y a vraiment un désavantage.
Oui, je pense que Anna, tu as vraiment mis des mots sur un peu un début de cercle vicieux. Donc, ils sont plus prônes à avoir des amendes, ils sont dans l'espace public, ils ont déjà des problèmes sous-jacents. La police intervient, il y a une date de cours. Ils ne se présentent pas à date de cours parce qu'ils n'ont peut-être pas un agenda, ils ont peut-être des problèmes d'organisation, peut-être qu'ils ont oublié, peut-être qu'ils ne comprennent pas le système, ils n'ont pas d'avocat. Donc là, des faux mandats émis envers eux. La police va les réarrêter. ils sont arrêtés. Quand des faux mandats, ils peuvent arrêter la personne. Puis là, quand ils sont ressortis avec une promesse de comparaître, ils ont des conditions. Ces conditions-là, ça peut être ne pas boire de l'alcool, ne pas aller dans cette zone-là, avoir un couvre-feu. Toutes des choses qui sont excessivement difficiles à respecter pour certaines personnes. Et là, ça fait en sorte qu'ils brisent l'approbation. Et puis là, c'est une autre charge. Donc, c'est vraiment un cercle vicieux qui s'enclenche, qui est vraiment dur à sortir. Puis là, c'est comme si le système ne contribuait pas du tout là, à la réinsertion, mais au contraire, était comme une barrière.
I think one thing too to consider with the criminalization of poverty is it's an issue that arises too when instead of having resources or responses that actually address some of the, you know, root causes of homelessness, when we're looking at affordable housing, healthcare, food security, it's an approach instead where lawmakers are adapt measures or regulations to just make unhoused people disappear from public spaces, right? So throughout Canada, there's local and provincial regulations that prohibit certain behaviors in public spaces, parks, subway stations, sidewalks, for example. And this has resulted in a really disproportionate number of fines and tickets being issued to people who experience homelessness. So it's a sanctioning of behaviors that aren't inherently wrong. And it's when people are resorting to survival street tactics, often end up being highly criminalized and face really, really steep fines. And I think we see this a lot, you know, in the under the health decrees and with the curfew, for example, where a lot of the people we work with, you know, not only were there not enough beds and shelters for people to actually shelter during the curfew, but it's actually a very reasonable survival tactic to choose to not enter a shelter during a pandemic, right? Where some of the shelters did experience COVID outbreaks. And so to be fined and penalized and criminalized for trying to survive by finding safe spaces outdoors, I think is the essence of the criminalization of poverty.
Pour étendre sur cette idée-là, c'est sûr que les personnes qui vivent en situation d'itinérance, c'est l'exemple le plus extrême. Et il y a eu beaucoup de gens qui ont parlé du fait que le couvre-feu est mal adapté pour des gens qui sont marginalisés, mais ne sont pas nécessairement dans la situation extrême d'être en situation d'itinérance. Puis de restreindre le mouvement de personnes quand certaines personnes ont beaucoup de riches, ont beaucoup de place, alors que d'autres vivent dans des petits logements, sont peut-être victimes de violences conjugales et sont en situation de précarité, c'est quelque chose qui pourrait les pousser justement à être encore plus précaires, qui pourrait les pousser dans la rue. Donc, c'est aussi des mesures qui vont non seulement criminaliser la pauvreté, mais créer plus de pauvreté aussi.
Puis aussi pour faire du plus sur cette conversation-là, puis on a déjà commencé à l'aborder un peu ce point-là, mais qu'est-ce que vous avez observé au niveau là, comme de la rencontre, de l'itinérance avec comme, la pandémie, puis plus particulièrement là, les mesures gouvernementales qui ont été déployées par la CAQ pour enrayer la pandémie? Fait que, bon, là, ça va être un peu plus compliqué pour Émilie parce que la clinique a comme commencé, puis ça arrive tout de suite. Mais comme, qu'est-ce que vous avez observé? Puis aussi, est-ce que votre mandat a comme évolué en fonction de ça?
Totalement. Les activités de la clinique ont vraiment été troublées là, par les nouvelles mesures. Justement, il y a la tradition de, comme on a dit, aller une fois par mois. Mais dès le début octobre, on est tombé dans la zone orange ou rouge. Puis, ce n'était plus possible là, pour des raisons de sécurité pour les cliniciens. Donc, on ne pouvait plus faire une certaine partie des activités qui devaient se faire en présentiel. Plusieurs des usagers qui avaient l'habitude de nous voir une fois par mois, d'après des témoignages du directeur, M. Donald Tremblay, vivaient une grande anxiété exacerbée. Donc, c'est certain que notre travail à la clinique est vraiment mis en défi là, à cause des mesures, parce que nous, c'est un travail vraiment qu'on doit faire en présentiel.
Yeah, and again, touching on the pandemic and homelessness, I was wondering, yeah, what are your take on what we can learn from the use of discretionary powers by the police in regard of how the curfew has been applied to houseless person and keeps actually on being applied even after the Superior Court granted the injunction we were talking about earlier.
Je tiens à souligner que Le pouvoir discrétionnaire de la police est complexe parce qu'il y a des policiers qui sont bien intentionnés et quand on a dit qu'on veut faire preuve de tolérance, c'est des policiers qui avaient peut-être l'intention de faire preuve de tolérance, mais l'itinérance, parfois, c'est très visible et parfois, ça l'est moins. Donc, il y a eu des cas de personnes en situation d'itinérance qui ont reçu des amendes, qui n'ont pas osé dire qu'ils avaient reçu, qu'ils étaient en situation d'itinérance, puis le policier ne l'a pas compris, puis il y a eu comme quelque chose qui est un peu lost in translation. Et justement parce que les gens avaient peur de l'autorité de la police, ils n'ont pas voulu s'exprimer là-dessus. Et dans les cas où ils ont fait preuve de tolérance, leur notion de tolérance, c'était d'orienter des gens vers les refuges. Et comme Émilie, elle l'a dit tout à l'heure, c'est une technique de survie très rationnelle de dire « moi, je ne veux pas aller dans un refuge parce qu'il y a des éclosions de COVID et il y a toutes sortes d'autres raisons valables pour ne pas aller dans un refuge. Quand tu as des problèmes de dépendance, tu ne peux pas consommer dans un refuge. Il y a plusieurs refuges qui n'acceptent pas les animaux de compagnie, mais il y a plusieurs personnes en situation d'itinérance qui vont partager leur vie avec un animal de compagnie. Il y en a qui ne sont pas à l'aise pour des raisons de discrimination. Donc, il y a toutes sortes de raisons valables pour ne pas aller dans un refuge. Et quand les policiers vont amener quelqu'un vers un refuge, si la personne refuse de collaborer avec la police, elle peut lui donner une amende pour manque de collaboration. Donc, même s'ils ont été tolérants, comme on l'a voulu à la base, et qu'ils ne leur ont pas donné une amende parce qu'ils sont dehors, ils leur ont donné une amende parce qu'ils n'ont pas collaboré pour des raisons qui sont très valables. Donc, il y a toutes sortes de façons cachées qui font en sorte que les personnes avec qui on travaille ont reçu des amendes avant qu'il y ait une exemption. Puis c'est pour ça qu'on avait besoin d'une exemption.
I think something that's concerning about broadening police discretionary powers during the health crisis is that it leaves too much room for social and racial profiling to happen, and it increases the risks of discriminatory applications of these kinds of health degrees. At Resilience, our team started to notice more and more people who were getting fines related to the curfew measures, the distancing, the mask wearing. We even had someone who came to us after the Superior Court granted the injunction he was fined for being out after curfew because the police didn't believe that he was unhoused. And he didn't have any proof to show that he didn't have a home or a shelter to take refuge in, right? And so he had come to the shelter to try and find out how to contest the fine, but also asking for documentation to be able to prove that he was experiencing homelessness. And it's a really dehumanizing experience to have to go through. And we've, I recently spoke with some of the staff members at Resilience and saying, they describe the handing of fines to homeless folks as almost a bullying tactic, right? Like there's no way that they can pay a $1,500 fine. And the police know that very well. And it's an incredibly dehumanizing process to have to go through and to have to prove your homelessness so that you can shelter yourself or shield yourself from a $1,500 fine that you couldn't possibly pay. So I think we need to rethink the really broad discretionary powers during a public health crisis, because I personally think it actually kind of runs counter to harm reduction principles, which are much more effective public health strategies than criminalization and heavy-handed police powers.
Aussi, yeah, kind of out of the pandemic all of a sudden, but I was kind of curious to know also your thoughts on like the intersection of law and homelessness. Like, obviously, you're all law students and like volunteering that capacity at the clinic, and like law is a tool that you're kind of using to uplift, but it's like mostly because poverty is being criminalized in the first place. So yeah, I was just curious about like avenues you would think that law can be used to like truly uplift persons experimenting houselessness, if there are any, and yeah, beyond this like damage control.
A lot of the people that we work alongside at Resilience are Indigenous folks who reside around Cabot Square. And I think it's important for us to think about to consider some of the limitations of Canadian law for achieving this, which is itself rooted in colonialism. And I think it's important to think about or reflect on how, in the work that we do, how can we support efforts to revitalize Indigenous legal traditions and to recognize these sort of inherent limitations of a colonial
legal tradition.
But a lot of the time, we're not using the law to empower. We're using it because they've been criminalized and we're trying to defend. And I think part of the reason behind this is that some of the legal tools we have in our society, like the charter, don't recognize poverty, for example, as a ground for discrimination. And so if there's something else that's cross-cutting, right? If someone is racialized, or if there's a gender issue and it's tied, then maybe there would be the tool to empower. But if they're being criminalized for their poverty, if the discrimination they're experiencing is directly caused by their poverty, there's no legal tool, at least that I know of, that we can really use to argue that these situations are absurd or invalid or unjust.
I think we've had similar experiences with resilience where, you know, we're using the knowledge that we're gaining in law school to be able to help people navigate an incredibly difficult, bureaucratic, and daunting system. And so it feels like these ad hoc responses, like we're trying to use the law to protect their interests, but it doesn't, I would agree with Anna that it's not an uplifting process. And I think actually going through the court system can be quite a crushing process and quite a scary process to have to go through. And something that I've been thinking a lot about as a law student is how can we use our expertise and the knowledge that we're gaining in movement lawyering? Like how can lawyers help support movements that are trying to fight for broader systemic changes? One area that I am particularly interested at the moment is defunding the police. And how can I use the knowledge that I have as a law student or as a lawyer down the road to be able to support movements and activists and organizers who are doing this kind of work to try and fight for systemic change? And how can I use that skill to try and uplift them and to help them in that organizing and in that movement work? So that's something that I think about in terms of what's the possibility for law? How can we lawyer for movements? And how can we lawyer for broader changes?
Ouais, aussi un autre truc dont j'avais envie de parler, c'est, mais à RADLA, on a comme vraiment un mandat de comme horizontalité, si on veut, puis c'est-à-dire qu'on essaie vraiment de s'impliquer, puis de comme renoncer à genre un espèce de titre d'expert, puis c'est ça, pour vraiment comme c'est servir nos communautés sur un axe horizontal, puis ouais, mais je me demandais comment comme cette considération-là elle peut modeler votre pratique, votre approche aux personnes que vous soutenez, etc.
Je vais parler en tant que clinicien de la clinique juridique itinérante et en tant que jeune étudiant, je n'ai pas l'impression qu'il n'y a aucune forme d'expertise qui m'est comme partagée ou accrochée à mon identité présentement. C'est vraiment les tâches que je fais, c'est des tâches que je fais qui sont assez simples, mais qui sont des énormes défis pour certaines personnes. Donc, c'est vraiment, j'ai pas l'impression que dans le contexte dans lequel je travaille présentement, j'ai besoin de grandes connaissances légales. C'est plus des questions humaines, de responsabilité, de ponctualité, pour être sûr d'être présent et alerte. Mais je dirais que je pense pas qu'on attend de l'expertise de moi. Et je pense pas, mais on attend peut-être du professionnalisme pour tout ce qui est confidentialité, justement. Et je pense que les usagers sont très, très reconnaissants. Et ça, c'est vraiment, je me sens choyé pour ça.
I think on our end, with resilience, one thing that I try to remind myself or that I try to integrate that kind of practice is to remember the importance of people's stories. So people come to us with a lot of complex human stories. And in law school, we're so often taught to narrow it down to the relevant legal facts. And I think in the work that we do, it's important to actually kind of resist that training and to remember that there's a person behind these stories, and to give space for that story and not make assumptions about what the best remedy is for them, and actually to actively listen and to make space for that whole complexity and the whole story to try and understand how to better assist them to seek the best solution for them, and not make assumptions about what the right strategy or the right remedy or the right solution would be.
Puis aussi, ben, juste pour rebondir, Laurence, un truc que tu mentionnais, comme la clinique essaie de monter un bond aussi ben, pour établir comme des patterns de discrimination systémique, comme si une cour like happened to find such a pattern recognizing like houselessness and poverty, like what could that mean?
Superbe question. J'imagine que le pari, c'est dans l'optique d'une plaidoirie éventuellement, autant d'un point de vue juridique, mais aussi peut-être politique, pour qu'il y ait des changements de législation. Mais je ne sais pas exactement à quel point la Cour accueille ou est ouverte à ce genre de données. Ça reste à être déterminé. Mais l'objectif, c'est vraiment de montrer qu'on ne peut pas agir avec cette population-là de la même manière qu'on agit avec d'autres populations. Parce que ils ont tellement des besoins et des réalités particulières que le statu quo est juste contre-productif et ne respecte pas leur dignité. Donc, je pense que la seule réponse satisfaisante serait vraiment un changement radical et pas une reconnaissance ou quoi que ce soit.
Yeah, totally.
J'avais vu cet été que le nombre de personnes en situation d'itinérance en ville, en fait, avait doublé depuis le début de la pandémie, puis ça, tu sais, c'était cet été-là, avant même qu'il y ait la deuxième vague. Ouais. Qu'est-ce que vous avez à dire là-dessus?
Je pense qu'à voir les places qu'il y a dans les refuges et le type de problématiques auxquelles on fait face, on réalise que ça grandit dans le sens où s'il y a plus de gens qui vivent un peu cette itinérance cachée, c'est peut-être à cause de la précarité, de la pandémie. Et je pense que des gens qui, autrement, seraient capables d'être plus mobiles ou nomades dans leur façon de vivre sans être complètement à la rue, ça devient plus difficile avec la pandémie parce qu'on est vraiment restreint à un endroit. Et donc, des gens qui étaient déjà sur le bord, ça les pousse un peu dans le gouffre. Mais je pourrais pas dire... étant donné, je sais pas si c'est à cause de ce que moi je sais ou si parce que on a moins de nouveaux usagers à la clinique juridique itinérante parce qu'on ne peut pas se rendre physiquement dans les refuges. Donc, il y a des gens qui vont nous appeler et il y a des dossiers qu'on avait avant qui demeurent actifs. Donc, moi j'ai, par exemple, j'ai seulement travaillé sur des dossiers avec des usagers qui sont rentrés en contact avec la clinique avant la pandémie. Donc, je ne sais pas, Laurent, si tu en sais plus, mais j'ai l'impression qu'on est plus déconnecté de la communauté qu'on l'était avant. Donc, c'est difficile de savoir exactement qui lui arrive en même temps.
Oui, probablement que les étudiants, étant donné qu'on n'a pas pu aller depuis octobre dans les refuges, donc il y a comme une distance qui s'est créée, mais de ce que j'ai lu de la demande de la clinique juridique itinérante, c'est vraiment que beaucoup d'appels là, ont été dirigés par des usagers, ont été dirigés vers le directeur pour justement dire que l'anxiété a augmenté. Puis après, on lit beaucoup dans les articles que les refuges, la place d'un refuge n'est pas suffisante et même si à cette place, arrimée avec le couvre-feu et les mesures sanitaires, ça fait en sorte que certaines personnes se cachent et quand tu te caches de la police ou des autorités, ben là, tu peux te mettre dans une situation dangereuse. Comme plein de problématiques qui ont comme été exacerbées. Puis, voilà.
Yeah, I think something that's important to consider too is that a lot of times when people are imagining the experience of homelessness, they think of life on the street. But for a lot of people, it just means precarious forms of housing and bouncing around between different couch surfing or friends' houses. And the pandemic's made that a lot harder. It's a lot harder to just move around between homes or between apartments. And I think that's resulted in more people finding themselves in precarious situations in the street. In terms of increases in numbers, I mean, at Resilience, we had to adapt relatively quickly by offering services outdoors. So after about a month, you know, a month or two of the lockdown, we finally started offering services again. But everything had to be outdoors initially. And so that's presented itself with its own challenges, especially in the wintertime. People aren't hanging around in the same way. It's difficult to recognize some people as we're wearing our masks. Sometimes it can be difficult to connect when you have to have, you know, keep this big space between each other. So it definitely changes the way that the services are provided. but it's encouraged us to be creative in how we continue to reach the people that we work with. And the team at Resilience has been incredible and has really continued to offer a lot of services despite the constraints. And they recently set up a heated tent so that people have a space to spend, you know, the evening during the curfew and stay warm and stay connected with people. And I think that's been an incredible addition.
I also, I volunteered at Resilience during the first confinement, but not with the illegal clinic, just, with Paul's cooking and everything. And it was, the, outside thing was, so impressive and so, such a logistic thing, too. I just remember that we had, these enormous plate of soup for 100% fucking hot in the hand, and we had to walk, I don't know, 200 meters to the park with this fucking heavy, dangerous, hot thing in the hand. And yeah. So yeah, I guess that's, yeah, for the last minute, is there anything that you would like to add or highlight or whatever?
One last thought, actually, and I don't know how you'll integrate it into the discussion, but one of our caseworkers who I was chatting with the other day highlighted, and I think it's important to consider, is one of the sort of unknown or less seen impacts of all the COVID-19 measures is that it makes the bureaucratic system that much harder to navigate because nothing's accessible, right? Nothing's open. Mm. And so people who have to try and contest tickets or access documents, suddenly they can't access their emails at the library. It makes it much harder to access public services. And so it has a huge impact on access to justice more generally.
Et moi, de mon côté, juste pour partir de cette certaine point, oublié, mais à la clinique, on ne pourrait pas faire notre travail sans des partenaires avocats qui travaillent bénévolement, notamment chez l'aide juridique. Donc, pour avoir collaboré avec certains d'entre elles, je suis très content qu'elles soient là puis qu'elles donnent si bon service. Puis ça ne serait pas possible sans elles. Donc, les avocats à l'aide juridique. Shout out. Voilà.
Le mot final, peut-être que je suis trop optimiste, mais quand je lis le jugement de la Cour supérieure et que je vois les arguments qui ont été amenés de l'avant par une firme qui a fait le cas pro bono, on a aussi un merci à Trudel Johnson et Espérance, mais quand je vois que la juge les a bien reçus, parce que je me souviens, j'étais dans le Zoom du procès, puis j'étais comme pas sûre qu'elle allait accepter, elle avait l'air vraiment sceptique. Et puis quand tu vois le jugement qui est rendu, je me dis, il y a peut-être un avenir à trouver. Justement, on a parlé d'utiliser la loi pour empower. Il y a peut-être moyen de trouver des arguments pour aider ces personnes-là au lieu d'être criminalisées, à être empowered par la loi, parce que la justice, ça peut aussi faire ça.
Aussi, pour bondir sur ça, je pense que c'est le jugement m'a donné beaucoup d'espoir parce que du monde n'a plus le temps de raconter une histoire. Et surtout à travers des témoignages. Donc, il y a eu un usager qui avait été comme profilé, puis qui avait reçu plein d'amendes. Puis son histoire est très touchante, puis elle illustre parfaitement le problème, puis le cercle vicieux. Puis si on est capable de mettre ces histoires de l'avant, de les faire insérer dans des milieux juridiques, je pense que ça peut vraiment faire une différence. La puissance des histoires.
That was Legalese Les Autres speaking with McGill Law Peers, Emily Knox, Laurent Côté de la Grave, and Anna Guignac-Eddy. Vous écoutez une émission de Legally sur CKUT 90.3 FM. That's all from us today. Thank you for listening, and thank you to everybody who contributed to the show. You can listen to Legally's every second Friday of the month from 11 a.m. to 12 noon on CKUT 90.3 FM. If you have any ideas of topics you'd like us to cover, legal or not, you can write to us at legalese@ckut.ca. We'll leave you with a track from Tom Waits, Come On Up on the House.
Well, the moon is broken and the sky is cracked. Come on up to the house.
can see is all that you lack. Come on up to the house. All your crying don't do no good. Come on up to the house. Come down off the cross. We can use the wood. You gotta come on up to the house. Come on up to the house. Come on up to the house. The world is not my home. I'm just a passing through. You got to come on up to the house.
Afternoon, you're tuned to Butcher T's Noontime Cuts, hitting every Friday from noon to 2, playing your wide variety of music just to make your afternoon delight just right. So stay locked to CKT 90.3 FM.